Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, and today I'm recording from the Grange in the landline. It's amazing. And I'm here with Sean Dombrowski from Trumansburg, New York. Hi, Sean.
It's true. Hi.
True. So Trumansburg, New York is kind of becoming its own little Hardwick. Will you mind just giving a little orientation on the area?
Sure. So Trumansburg, New York is like smack dab in the middle of the Finger Lakes area, which is kind of smack dab in the middle of New York State, about 12 miles or so north of Ithaca, New York, where Cornell University is, and Ithaca College, and being a couple miles north of downtown Ithaca, basically start getting really into big open farmland. And there's a whole lot of different interesting small-scale and medium-scale farms all in this area, and still a fair bit of good culture and social space and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a real nice area to live and to work and to do the farming that I do. There's a lot of great folks that are also doing similar things.
And there's in Trumansburg, they have this amazing laundromat that has these like turquoise washing machines from the 1950s, and they also have Wi-Fi, and it's so beautiful.
It's true, yeah. You can do your laundry there, and there's oddly culturally insensitive signage on the walls. It's a very strange, very strange scene in there. There's some things about Trumansburg that it's like new-ish, and there's a very old school feeling to the space as well. But it's a good town.
So, hi, Sean. How are you?
Hi.
What's going on?
Just this and that. how have you been?
I've been good. I've been out in California. We were doing organizing around land access, and so now I'm back in the cold and adjusting.
Yeah. It's been wonderful to have it be feeling like an actual winter recently.
I know.
I've been up to... We're currently trying to harvest a bunch of sugar maple logs or bolts to put shiitake mushrooms into this spring, and hauling in tons and tons of truckloads of horse manure and wood chips and coffee grinds and all sorts of stuff to build up compost piles that are cooking down for spring fertility, and just getting ready in all the ways that I can while the ground is frozen to be ready for a big growing season this year. I have a woman coming out tomorrow who is an agent for the New York State Ag and Licensing for me to be a registered nursery for the state of New York. And so I've been trying to get ready and cleaned and organized for that and be ready to become a small-scale nursery come this spring. So lots of new projects to work on, even though it's been like soundly below freezing for the last many days. It's been a very productive time.
Wow. I didn't know you were going to become a commercial nursery. That's amazing. Let's talk about the evolution of your farm business, just to give folks some orientation.
Sure. It's a very small-scale thing. So I have a project that I call Edible Acres, and there's more information online if people want to see. It's pretty outdated, but I have edibleacres.org as a website that has some information and background. Basically, it's 6 acres that I'm on here that I share with my family. It's a very small-scale forest farming project. It's a home and a homestead first and a small-scale farm and permaculture research space as a close second. And so my whole, the whole thing here is I've been on this property for, this will be the beginning of the fifth growing season when things start to thaw out this year. And so it's been four growing seasons so far of really kind of slowly shaping the marginal, flat, prone to flooding 6 acres of land that we're on into a really high-density forest farm. So there's, you know, a few thousand different tree crops that have been planted, you know, black locust for fuel wood and for nitrogen fixation, and chestnuts dotted throughout, and hazelnuts and this and that.
And a lot of it is very extra. You can make syrup out of black locust also.
I'm sorry, what's that?
You can make black locust syrup from, like, sap.
Ooh, huh.
Like, yeah.
Well, I should do that.
Yeah.
Although they're pretty young right now. It's funny you mentioned that. Somebody was just asking, because we were going to harvest these sugar maple logs for mushroom production, and they were wondering about other trees that you can make sap or syrup from. And I know folks have been doing black walnut and pretty happy with the results, and we were thinking about birch syrup and what that would be like and how nice that would taste. And black locust, I never thought to try. Is it good?
I don't know. My friend, we're talking about tree sap, and my friend Connor Stedman, he's a permaculture geek also.
Mm-hmm.
You might know him. He lives in Vermont.
I don't know if I do know him.
You don't know him? You should know each other. You would like each other.
Well, okay. should meet at a potluck sometime.
Yeah, we should create some kind of an event where people socialize or something like that.
That sounds very good.
So, okay, so we're talking about your different tree crops. Tell me some more.
Sure. A lot of the work that's going on here is planting out as many different types of trees and shrubs that I've heard about or have interest in but haven't really seen in production, and just trying to give them a fair share to get established and understand what sort of yields they can provide and what sort of markets they might be able to open up and work into. So like some of the more exciting things that I've been experimenting with in the last few years are Nanking cherries have been seeming to be a really promising shrub and fruit crop. They get no protection from mice, voles, and deer, and they get girdled like crazy every winter, but they still make huge fruit sets every spring, and that's been exciting. Goji berries seem like they have some really good viability, even though it's a pretty cold winter area here. Trying to see how hardy hazelnuts are deep in the shade and whether or not they'll still provide good yields in challenging kind of semi-flooded spaces, and whether or not they'll be black walnut tolerant. And just lots of experiments, and kind of the secondary thing is the marketable yield of fruit or nuts. And so that's why I kind of moved towards the idea of setting up this space as a nursery rather than a production farm, because there will be things that won't produce because I'm like really experimenting with where they're planted or how they're treated. But it feels like each spring I just have a huge excess of new plants, since they're all pretty hardy, mobile, perennial things that I'm working with here. So,
well, and you're not alone in that business model. I mean, obviously, the famous one is the Bullock brothers up on Orcas. They have a permaculture nursery, but my friend Krista Farmer and my friend Logan and, like, all the dudes who are permy dudes who've gone to a lot of trouble to collect rare tree crops and Thule's trees, and, you know, then they all just start air layering and
mm-hmm.
propagating and potting up and selling.
Yep. Yeah, it's just a very natural extension that you have kind of an interest bordering on obsession with new plants and understanding all these new things. And so each year, you know, I buy in and bring on some new seeds or some new rootstock or trade with folks, and But then each spring I'm also, you know, left with this variety of raspberry that's just run amok and taken over a pathway. And so I'm ready to either dig it up and compost them, or better yet, you know, barter with them, or even better yet is earn some money so that I can buy more plants. You know, it's not really a business model where it's like, you know, get rich quick or any, I don't think there's any farm models that really do that, but...
It's called marijuana.
Right, well, we'll see how that goes for New York State, but for now I'm sticking with the sea kale and the air potatoes and the Nanking cherries, and we'll see what works with that.
Do Nanking cherries, are they good in pies? Are they sour, or are they more like soppy sweet?
They're more sour.
Awesome.
They definitely have a good sugar content, but I would describe them as being about one-third the size of an average sweet cherry and about six times the flavor.
Wow.
So they're a lot smaller. They've got a big seed-to-pulp ratio, but the flavor is really rich and complex. So, and you can stand at one of these shrubs rather than being up on a ladder and, you know, kind of seeking out all these random cherries and popping them off. You can basically just strip 40 or 50 off in one stroke on these flexible low branches and just have, you know, handfuls of these little tart, sour, bold, interesting red jewels.
Wow.
And they flower about a week before the forsythia up here. And as crazy as the weather was this spring with all the way too hot, way too early, and then a frost in mid-April, they just kind of carried right on through all that roller coaster of weather and still put on a huge fruit set, whereas a lot of the farmers in this area had some pretty devastating crop loss on their cherries and apples. And so it's kind of a reminder that each year I want to bring on more fruit crops that are not grafted, that are really hardy to a wide range of conditions and, you know, are unique, because I can go and get sweet cherries when there's a good year, but I don't know where else to get Nanking cherries or fresh, raw goji berries around here.
Well, and I mean, up in Michigan, so my favorite cherry, commercial cherry, is the Montmorency cherry. They make sour cherry syrup. It's from Eden Foods in Michigan. It's like crack cocaine, this stuff. So I want to come to your farm and make cherry syrup. But last year, the Montmorency cherry growers in Michigan had 90% crop loss.
Right.
Because of the crazy early thaw and then hard cold after. So
right.
This question about where are we doing the research about resiliency and planning for what seems like inevitable climate change, whether or not it's politically correct or accepted or USDA approved, it seems like the climate is going to be changing.
Right.
What's your perspective on that?
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, whether or not it's happening. I mean, I just heard a statistic recently that if you are 27 years old or younger, you've never experienced a colder than average month in your entire life. Now, I can't remember exactly where I heard that, but it sounds about right. It feels like each year, each month is warmer than it's been before. But then along with that is, it gets warmer every summer, but it's also, it just feels like so much more tumultuous year-round. Like it's much wetter and then much drier, and then, you know, it's kind of all over the place. And so my whole feeling is there's nothing I'm going to be able to do about changing climate stuff or changing political will around on like a global scale. So the only thing I think that I feel like I can do within the power of what I have is to just plant as much different species diversity as possible and at least empirically get my head around what seems to be thriving when things are chaotic. You know, what things can handle extreme heat and extreme cold, droughty conditions. I mean, I don't, for the four growing seasons that I've had here, I haven't used well water once for irrigation. I'm completely dependent on rainwater. So I store as much as I can, but any crop that's going to thrive at edible acres has to be a crop that can deal with drought conditions and can deal with seasonal flooding, because that's basically, I'm on this flat, shallow to bedrock silt, and right now I've got, water underneath the ice moving around and seeking lower routes to get away from here. And in the summer, it'll be cracked and dry, so it's really challenging. And so there are lots of random crops that I'll try that just kind of disappear by the end of the season because they just can't handle that sort of stress. So I'm propagating the things that stick around and proliferate. And so it's kind of like self-selecting for chaos happiness.
I feel like a lot of times we think, oh, well, there's all these different heirloom varieties. And, I'm just going to go into the catalog or the museum or the database and, choose one of the nice of these heirloom varieties that were developed in this, golden age of agriculture. You know, when in fact, that golden age of agriculture is only a relic.
What's my feeling on that, or?
I was on a little, rampage, but I was about to talk about adaptive selection. I feel like sometimes we, even as alternative, progressive, engaged, open pollinated oriented gardeners, think about the arsenal of varieties that we have as a kind of static, as like an arsenal, as a hard drive, or as a, relic of a past, of like a golden era. And in fact, we have all the tools that our ancestors had to adapt plants ourselves and to selectively breed our own heirloom varieties and adapt varieties that we like or that work well in our climate or that can put up with our extremes or make a good cider or whatever it is that our human instincts drive us to select for in combination with what the nature throws at it in the place where we are. And now all this sounds kind of obvious when I say it, but I do feel like the consciousness needs to be raised on this topic. And that's part number one. Point number two is I have a friend out in California, and he's going around to, old mining camps and abandoned homesteads and basically getting, most of those would be, seedling plums and seedling pears and that have basically are now, 400-year-old trees because they're from homesteading times. Or 300.
Yeah.
Or 400 years is really long. Maybe they're younger than that because it's California. So it's probably
right.
Only 200-year-old trees. Anyway, the point is there could be trees that would be almost as old as this country. So he's taking those trees or the seedlings that grew that from the mother tree that grew up around and starting with those as a strategy for getting really up into the genetics. Do you have any of those theories or thoughts or practices?
Yeah, I would say I certainly am doing a huge amount of seed saving. And I just joined, there's a seed savers collective that's starting to happen in the Ithaca area. We have an event coming up in late February where people can come and trade seeds or get seeds if they need them. And so I'm getting involved with these other folks that are really interested in seed saving. And I think where I particularly come from with it is I'm not so interested in really specific, specialized look or taste of things. I want crops that are very, very hardy and just kind of take care of themselves. And when my criteria is simple and that's really what I'm going for, then doing that sort of selection just happens naturally. I'm presented each year with the kale plants that are the tallest and have the biggest, healthiest seed heads as the ones that I will go ahead and save seed from, or the lettuce that just somehow randomly coasts all the way through winter and bolts in the spring and makes seeds, that's who I'm selecting for. And so in the long run, I might actually be selecting more for these kind of like feral, mongrel, aggressive versions of fine and dainty heirlooms, but I'll end up with crops that once they're set in motion, they'll have perennial, persistent sort of energy to them, and they'll take care of themselves and be available on an as-needed basis without cultivation. And that to me is the most important thing. And I definitely appreciate and love that there are like 5,000 different varieties of tomatoes that you can pick from, but I like the idea of, you know, just kind of whipping cherry tomatoes into the forest, and whichever ones come up, and those are the ones that I'm eating and throwing back into the forest again in the little random open glades, and kind of having these wild vines growing with food shooting off of them. So the annual crops, you know, you've got such a fast turnaround by playing with them every year and selecting for the criteria you want, like the biggest leaf or the sweetest this or the greenest that. But for me, it's just like whoever presents the most seed generally gets my attention, and they'll be grown out the first year in the family garden where it's protected and they have access to the saved rainwater, and I can irrigate them and mulch them and weed them. And then once I have a pound of seed of this or that, it's just it moves out into the broad 5-acre, 6-acre forest context, and it's kind of just scattered seed, and kind of cross my fingers that something comes up.
So you just basically, you have a garden of badasses.
Yeah, a garden, a garden of dainties where badasses show up, and I gladly take their seed and put them out into the badass world and let them do their thing. And sometimes they'll just, you know, once they're out into a more wild, feral context, they disappear because they can't handle that sort of challenge. But, you know, over the last 4 years, I've been selecting for this type of kale that has a really good flavor, is really sweet, huge leaf, and makes tons and tons of seeds and will take care of itself. And for some reason, rabbits don't eat it unless they're absolutely starving. And so it's now becoming a weed on this property and on another farm where I shared that seed. It's just starting to turn into this persistent brassica that really is just like locking in as one of the weeds, you know, along with quackgrass and along with motherwort is this particular kale. And so I'd love to see that partnered with, you know, a type of lettuce that will be able to handle that kind of competition and that sort of stress, and some sort of spinach that just kind of sneaks in and holds its own amongst a big pile of grass. And
I feel like I
just kind of have food everywhere by throwing seeds at everywhere and not really working too hard beyond that. So I don't know if I can do that for the next 10 or 20 years. I'll end up with, yeah, a forest just loaded to the hilt with food that I periodically weed by eating it.
I wanted to make sure, well, first of all, I just wanted to tag for myself and for others that it'd be really interesting to do more research on land races and how indigenous cultures around the world manage the very distinct genetic varietals that they have. And I just learned about this one plant in Southeast Asia that's used for thatch and used for holding things. And they basically have this plant that grows like a weed, but they have 5 or 6 or 12 different kinds of it. It's called weepio. And it's wild, but it's maintained, and there's these different varieties that have different uses and are used in different times of the year. So anyway, this is just a tag for all of us to think about, like, what are indigenous seed breeding and methodologies, and where do we go learn about that? So I'm going to bring that question forward, but you can challenge your seed community also. I wanted to give you a chance to promote that seed event briefly. Is that Jeff who's organizing it?
No, the main person, there's a group of folks that are involved in organizing. I'd say the main person is Chris Gardner, who's involved at the Cornell Cooperative Extension. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure the exact website where folks can go, but if you went online and searched for Cornell Cooperative Extension, and specifically it's called CD Sunday, it's coming up on February the 24th, which is a Sunday, from I think 11 till 3. It's in Ithaca, New York, and anybody's welcome to go, whether or not you have seeds or not, it doesn't matter. You're invited to go, and the idea is that no money is to exchange hands. People are just trading ideas or seeds or getting themselves started. I'm going to be doing a presentation on really, really simple, low-tech, low-cost seed-saving techniques. A good friend of mine, Petra, is going to be putting on a presentation on selection and breeding for biennial plants. So there should be some really good information and definitely tons and tons of free seeds and a good opportunity to come. You know, if you've got some crazy beet that you got from your great-great-grandfather that you think the world should grow, then that's a great opportunity to bring it out and share.
Awesome. Seed swap. We posted the URL for that on our resource page because they made an amazing Seed Savers resource page for Cornell Cooperative Extension. I got it from the librarian at the Mann Library. Jeff.
Oh, yeah,
I like him.
Jeff. Yeah, there's some really good stuff happening in this area around that, and I think it's just such a critical thing to do. And the European Union, I guess, I don't know the full detail of it, but this Chris Gardner was sharing her experience in Ireland where she went and learned about seed saving, and I guess in the European Union there's some pretty heavy-duty legislation around control over the ability to not even sell seed, but to share or disseminate seed, you have to have licensing. You can be fined pretty heavily if you are just sharing seeds. You know, you have a really excellent variety of celery, and you hand those seeds off to somebody, and the wrong authority sees you doing it, and you can be fined for it, which is a really frightening idea. It seems as though the theme in corporate agriculture is to control genetics, and so having things in motion and having the social resilience around a good distributed seed dissemination and saving and sharing and knowledge network for all the different areas, I think is just so critical, even regardless of the corporate angles that are on top of all that, but just for our own sake, people can grow crops that work really well for their region by growing them. You know, if you buy in new seed that's raised in Oregon every year, you never really are moving closer to having plants that will thrive in your area. It's kind of always dependent on this genetics from far away that may or may not thrive in the conditions that you have on the ground where you live.
So, awesome. Everyone should go to CD Sunday this Sunday, Sunday the 24th. Then another thing I wanted to make sure to bring up, because when I met you, it was at the Farm Hack event we did in Ithaca at the Groundswell Incubator, and yep. You were doing an ad hoc presentation, an amazing ad hoc presentation, which we PS filmed. If you ever wanted to get footage, send me a hard drive. About your amazing, super cheap, ghetto gray water process. Number one question, did you post your process and methodologies and resources for how to do it on FarmHack, the website?
No, not yet.
Do you feel really
that.
Guilty admitting that in front of thousands of people?
Yeah, thanks. That was fun. I was hoping that if it got filmed, then it's all there and beautiful.
We're going to do all
digital,
the work for
high res. Yeah, I think I have video. My favorite way to document things is with video, and I did put up a video on YouTube that went over one of my systems that I came up with a few years ago, and I've since updated it a bit, but it has all the basic information on how to set up. And it's less about gray water for the systems I do here. It's more rainwater collection that I'm focusing on doing. And I'm trying to remember the name of that video, but I think I posted under the Good Life Farm a few years ago, which is a farm up in Interlaken that I'm associated with. I co-own the forest there, and they do some really amazing permaculture, broad-scale farming. And I think if you went on YouTube and searched for rainwater collection in Good Life Farm, you'd find some video documentation of it. My hope would be I want to share. The rainwater thing has been, it's been critical and like a core component of all of my farming here. And so I've put a lot of energy into collecting it and storing it and disseminating it around the farm without using any grid-tied stuff or fossil fuels. So I have some solar panels that charge old truck batteries that run bilge pumps that move water around. But other than that, it's all gravity-fed or passively moved around. And my hope is that folks that are really interested in doing that will take occasion sometime this spring or summer and be in touch and see the systems in action and ask lots of questions. And I definitely don't feel any proprietary ownership over the stuff that I'm figuring out here because it's all built on ideas from all sorts of random places. So
what you're saying is we need to find somebody who's willing to come out there and video document your systems and then open source it.
That would be awesome, yeah.
Done. I want to nominate myself. I want to come and see.
Well, please do. You're more than welcome. Yeah, there's probably like 15 different systems that are all catching water in slightly different ways and all at slightly different levels of efficiency and repeatability, some of which I would prefer not to show people because they're so poorly done, and some that I'm really excited to show the world. And but it's good to see like the whole iterate, like the original stuff and where all the leaks shoot out of and all the rain that's missed, to the current ones that are pretty efficient, to the ideas of where it can go in the future, so that you know every last drop that hits a roof surface is stored cleanly in a container and ready for distribution. This was a really challenging growing season. It was very hot and very, very dry, and I just barely had enough water to get through with just about 0% crop loss, which was an exciting, I mean, stressful, but an exciting challenge to have no access to well water and still have my basic farm system function during a very rough, hot drought. So rainwater is definitely a viable way to operate a small-scale farm or a huge home-scale garden, I think. And that's, I don't have 100% of the roof area online just yet. There's some nooks and crannies inside, like the north of the garage doesn't catch rainwater, the south does. That's more surface area that I'll get online this spring. But every drop of rain should be held on to as long as possible, like allowed to move through and onto destinations beyond, but to really take its sweet time getting there.
I like that idea. So, Resource Tag, there's a wonderful group. There's two wonderful groups. There's Rainwater Harvesters in Tucson, Arizona, led by Brad Lancaster. And then there's the Graywater Gorillas out of Oakland, California, led by a woman whose name is out of my mind right now. I'm sorry. But if you're interested in graywater or rainwater harvesting, those are two awesome places to look. You got any faves?
I'm sorry, do I have any what?
Do you have any favorite sources of inspiration on rainwater capture?
I don't know. I'm a big fan. I really like the like funky, sometimes useful, sometimes useless, but generally entertaining crowdsourcing method of looking at YouTube videos and just kind of seeing all these really, really different ways that people are going about it. I think that's where most of my inspiration has come from, is like seeing 60 or 70 different random systems and trying to think about how to distill out complexity from, you know, some of them are very, very low tech and very sloppy, and so they don't really work super great. And a lot of them are like incredibly elegant, but I think so over-engineered that they end up being very costly. It's kind of like this continual thing of like, what seems to be the like the least amount of stuff that's needed to make it work. I don't know. Yeah, I think just spending time and like giving myself the latitude to spend an evening looking at different videos and then looking at different links and documentation, kind of letting that slowly percolate into what is going to be the solution that works for me, has been really helpful with a lot of systems, and definitely with the rainwater collection. And I think it's just, you make one, you know, whatever it's going to be, a 30-gallon trash can that you scrub out with a Brillo pad and some Doc Bronners that still holds water, put it under a downspout and see what it does. And then, can you siphon water from that? Great. Can you throw an old bed sheet over it to filter the water? And, you know, like, you just slowly build up. I think if you start by buying, like, pre-built expensive kits, that's fine. But it's fun to just see water get stored. Even, like, a 5-gallon bucket underneath your downspout is a start, you know. I think just doing it and looking at what other people that are randomly doing it are doing is a great way to go.
Sean says, just do it, folks. Sean, I'm gonna come out there and video you sometime. I don't know if I can make it on Sunday, but I would like to document this. I think one of the major things that I've noticed from FarmHack is getting people to document in the early stages of their innovation period is easier than once they've figured it out, because the motivation of the novice is somehow has a different character than the motivation of the I've already figured this out person.
Hmm.
And that we need to build a culture of documentation all along the way.
Yeah.
But that's fine. That's an insight that can be applied to a system. So we just apply it.
Documentation is really important, and it comes in spurts when I find myself taking the time to pause and like doing a quick short video, or at least taking some photographs. I find at the very least, if I take a bunch of random photographs as I'm doing something, I can look back at it a year later or 2 years later and be like, oh yeah, that's what it looked like at the very beginning. And could always build out notes from there, but that takes almost no effort. And that's at least a place to start with any system, is just having some quick photographs to document where you're at the beginning, middle, and end.
So we come to the end of our time, and I'm very thankful for the Permi representation and for your amazing energy at the FarmHack. You were like Superman, and you came and did your talk right at the right moment before lunch. And anyway, it was very great.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun to share that. It was a good venue to kind of geek out on the random systems as they're getting figured out. And this was a lot of fun to be on the phone with you and chat about stuff that is, I think, really important and a lot of fun to talk about.
Totally. We'll do it some more. So just so you know, there's FarmHacks coming up in March 16th and 17th in Detroit. And then there's two in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then in North Durham, Vermont. So there's a Teamster Farm Hack in the fall in September. There's a soil decontamination and urban farming farm hack in Detroit and Ann Arbor in March. And then in between is the Minneapolis. And then we didn't get the funding for the California one, so we had to postpone it. Unfortunately, all these organic companies are fighting off the GMOs, so they're spending all their grant money, and we had to reapply. But once we get a GMO victory, then there'll be more grant money. So this has been Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. It was fun to chat with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.